Whether or not they learn English themselves, they know that their children must speak it. Sometimes they go so far as to discourage their children from speaking their own language. They want them to get into good schools, to identify with their new culture, to be accepted by it in all the ways that they were not. The man looked knowingly at my mother as he explained. This second generation, he continued, might find themselves at great distance from the culture of their parents. Perhaps somewhere along the way, they are told to put the old culture behind them, and so they find it within themselves to reject it. As the second generation forms their own identity, he went on, it is more often built within the new culture rather than the old. By the time they have their own children, it usually turns out that this third generation is almost totally accepted. They have it easy. The culture of their grandparents' adopted country defines them wholly. However, he added, when they arrive at adulthood, they often begin to look around for something that makes them unique. And it's then that they begin to search for an inheritance, to look back for the traditions that make them special. And often, they realize it isn't there. They realize something has been lost along the way. My mother tells me that when I was born, she remembered the words of this man. She remembered all the ways she had grown up alienated from her own identity. I didn't want that for my son, she tells me. I wanted you to feel pride, to find strength in your heritage. Outside the law offices of Elizabeth Green, I sat in my truck, wondering what I was doing, what role I was playing, what protocols I had followed to arrive there. I sat with the engine idling, slowly shaking my head as I listened to the radio. It's simple, I finally told myself. This is what friends do. Inside, a receptionist directed me to a conference room upstairs. I entered to find Elizabeth and Diane already seated across the table from each other, chatting about Elizabeth's newborn. I greeted Diane and introduced myself to Elizabeth. I work for Diane, I told her. I'm a friend of Jose's. Diane leaned over to Elizabeth. He can speak Spanish, she said. He's been a big help to the family. How nice, Elizabeth said. I took a seat near the end of the table, beside a long window overlooking the mountains to the west. I listened to the woman and eyed the clock. Lupe was late. It's hard to sleep at night, Elizabeth was telling Diane. I hear him crying out for me in the next room. It's almost like I can hear him breathing through the walls. My phone rang. Lupe had arrived and needed help finding the office. I excused myself to go outside. In the parking lot, I found her walking with the pastor. I greeted them both. Nice to see you again, I told the pastor. How good of you to come. Upstairs, Elizabeth greeted everyone and invited us to sit down. She began in Spanish, speaking directly to Lupe in slow, deliberate sentences. Unfortunately, she said, Jose's situation is not rare. She looked around the room. But it is rare to see so many people here for one case. Usually, only the immediate family comes to a meeting like this. Elizabeth looked at Lupe and then gestured at me, Diane, and the pastor. Jose must have made quite an impression on you all, she said. Lupe watched us with her hands gathered in her lap. Elizabeth went on. I want to talk to you today about Jose so we can find the best strategy to keep him here. We're going to do everything we can, she told Lupe. Elizabeth placed a hand on the table and repeated her words. Todo lo posible. Elizabeth switched into English and glanced at me. Do you mind translating? She asked. No, I said. Of course not. I want to make a few things clear, she began. I want to temper expectations right off the bat. This case is going to be hard. Not impossible, but hard. She looked across the table at Diane. I also want to be clear that even if Jose is able to stay, it is unlikely that he'll be able to come back to work for you, because at this point, of course, you are no longer ignorant of his undocumented status. Diane shook her head. It's a shame. Jose was such a great employee, such a sweet man. Well, Elizabeth said, it's rare to see an employer invested in someone enough to come to these meetings. Rare for them to support someone's case against deportation. Diane shrugged. I really thought he had everything in order, she said. At first, we hired him on as an independent contractor. He filled out all his paperwork, had a social security number, and at the end of each year we gave him a 1099, It never occurred to me that even after months and years of working with us, he never asked to be put on payroll. He never asked for benefits. Maybe he just wanted to keep things vague to protect himself, to protect us from knowing his status. Dan looked around the table. I just never thought about it. Elizabeth leaned on the table. Given what you knew, she said to Diane, there's legally nothing wrong with what you did. But I want you to know that even in the best case scenario, Jose has no chance of being granted legal status. I want to be clear here, to you, but most of all to Lupe, that what we are asking for in this case is not legalization. Under existing law, Jose doesn't really have a path to legal status until his oldest son turns 18 and can sponsor his mother and father for citizenship. And because Jose has a prior deportation on his record from 1996, we don't have a lot of options. Elizabeth turned to Lupe. I want to ask you a few questions to start off, she said. She glanced at me, and I began to translate. First of all, besides his past deportation, has Jose ever been in trouble with the law? Lupe shook her head. No, she said. Never. She looked over at the pastor. Jose used to drink, she admitted quietly. The pastor bowed his head. But he never got into any trouble, Lupe said. Gracias a Dios. Ever since our first son was born, he hasn't had a single drink. Good, Elizabeth said. This next question might be hard for you to answer, she continued, but it's an important one. Have you, Jose, or the boys, ever been the victims of a violent crime here in the U.S.? Lupe looked down at her hands, still clasped in her lap. No, she said. La verdad es que no. So, Elizabeth concluded, that leaves us with two options. The first is for Jose to claim fear of returning to Mexico. In that case, he would be held for a screening interview to see if he is eligible for something like asylum. He would remain in immigration custody for at least 6 months prior to being released on bond. I'm sorry, Lupe said. What does that mean, exactly? She looked at Elizabeth. Fear of returning to Mexico? Of course he has fear. La violencia, she said. La delincuencia, la corrupción. Elizabeth began to tap a pencil against her legal pad. Of course, she said. I'm sorry. What I mean by fear is something more specific. If Jose has received death threats, for example, from a drug cartel or some other group, if he's part of an ethnic or political minority that is being targeted somewhere, land disputes, blood feuds between or among families, things like this. Lupe clutched her hands in her lap and looked down, shaking her head. No, she said, nothing like that. Elizabeth rested her pencil at the top of her pad. Well, she said, I'll visit Jose in the detention center and talk with him, just to be sure. But to be clear, the ultimate goal of an asylum application wouldn't really be to win. Almost no one wins asylum from Mexico. Only about 1% of Mexican cases are actually granted asylum. But the process buys time, and the application would bolster a request for a stay of removal. As I translated Elizabeth's words, Lupe stared at me, expressionless. So, Elizabeth went on, that brings us to our second option, which is to ask for a deferred deportation under the executive actions that, for the time being, protect certain undocumented immigrants, such as non-criminal parents of U.S. citizens. The problem, of course, is that Jose has a prior deportation from 1996, and on top of that, his most recent exit and illegal reentry into the country. That means he's now considered a recent entrant, and recent entrants are a priority for deportation, even under these executive actions. So what we need to do is to try and make a great case for prosecutorial discretion. Basically, that means that we would present to a judge all the compelling reasons that Jose should still be granted a stay of removal, despite his recent entry. The goal here is to get Jose out of detention and, essentially, to buy time with the appeals process and hope for better policy and eventual immigration reform down the line. Jose would still have no work permit. He'd still be living in the shadows. But he'd be protected. He could remain there safely, if that makes any sense. Elizabeth shifted her gaze around the room, looking in turn at Diane, Lupe, the pastor, and me. So, she began again, Here's what I'll need from all of you. From you, Lupe, any and all documentation that establishes how long Jose has lived and worked in the States. Pay stubs and any tax information that proves employment, rental or lease agreements, utility contracts, anything else that establishes proof of continual residence. How long has Jose been in the U.S.? Lupe thought for a moment. More than 30 years, she answered. Elizabeth seemed surprised. Well, she said, if you can produce documents that establish a continual presence here for more than 30 years, that will be very good for his application. Also, she continued, we'll need any legal documents you can produce regarding your children. Birth certificates, report cards, health records. Health records are important. Do your boys have any health issues? Lupe looked towards her pastor and then over at me. My youngest son, Vicente, has a problem with his brain. He has problems speaking. She looked down at the floor. Jose Jr. has asthma. He was hit by a car, too, she said, a year and a half ago. He still has a limp. And Diego, my oldest, has meningitis. I'm sorry to hear that, Elizabeth told her. Documentation of all this will be very important for the application. Any evidence you can give of their medical conditions will help the case. Elizabeth turned toward me, Diane, and the pastor. Another thing that will help Jose's case are testimonies to his good character, she said. Letters from current and past employers, landlords, neighbors, churchgoers, and family members, particularly those with legal status. The more, the better. Any evidence of community service he's taken part in as a church member or in any other capacity would also help. The author should be sure to state how many years they've known Jose, in what capacity they've known him, and why they support him. Moral character, work ethic, etc. Examples are good, and the author should list specific things Jose has done that have impressed them or demonstrated that Jose is someone special or unique. If the author is familiar with the hardships his removal would place upon the family, that should be included in the letter as well. As Elizabeth spoke, I gazed out the window to the mountains, wondering how such hardships could be put into words. There's one last thing I need to get started, Elizabeth stated, and that's half the money to pay our legal fees. $2,000 of the $4,000 total. We'll pay for half, Diane said. My husband and I have already decided. Lupe's eyes widened, catching the glare from the sunlight filtering in through the windows. The pastor leaned forward in his chair and placed his arms on the table. The church will help Lupe pay the other half, he said. Elizabeth smiled. Fantastic, she said. Lupe looked around the room, unsure of what to say or how to react. Are there any questions? Elizabeth asked us. Diane held her hand up near her face. Maybe it's a bad time to ask, she said. But what happens if Jose's case is denied? Well, Elizabeth said, he'll be sent back to Mexico, of course, and that will happen quickly, right after the deportation order is issued. Sometimes we don't find out until after the decision has been made, after the person has already been deported. Immigration decisions don't happen in a courtroom, so we won't be arguing our case before a judge. We submit documents, and the decision is made behind closed doors. If Jose is deported, the charge will appear on his record, of course, and that will make it harder for him when and if he tries to legalize down the line. With this deportation, he'll receive a 5-year ban on reentry. Diane sighed. And if he tries to cross again, she asked. Elizabeth picked up her pencil. He'll serve more jail time each time he's picked up, she said. Instead of 30 days, next time it will probably be 60, then 90. And he'll be banned from reentry for 10 years, then 20, and so on. Elizabeth looked at Lupe and then eyed me to make sure I was ready to translate again. I want to be sure that you know where your husband is, she said. He'll be at the state detention center for the duration of the 30-day sentence he was issued at the criminal hearing. Lupe nodded to me and then at Elizabeth. After that, Elizabeth said, if Jose's case is still under consideration, which it probably will be, he'll be placed in the nearby immigration detention center. Elizabeth scrawled a number on a piece of paper and handed it to Lupe. This is his inmate number, she said. You'll need it if you have any dealings with the prison. Elizabeth tapped the pencil against her legal pad. Do you have questions? She asked us. Just one, Lupe said. Can the boys see their father? Elizabeth sat back in her chair. Well, she said, yes. The detention center allows visitation. She rested her pencil back on the table. But they check papers there, so it wouldn't be safe for you to go. You'd have to find someone else to take the boys. I drove through the trailer park in the early morning before the sun was up, looking for Jose's home. I finally found it, a double wide with two doors in a dirt lot next to a dumpster. The lights were off, and I knocked at each of the doors. After several minutes of waiting, I knocked louder, until finally I heard rustling inside and saw a light come on. Lupe opened the door and smiled weakly, her face heavy with sleep. Diego's getting ready, she said. He'll be out in a few minutes. Is it just him? I asked. Yes, she said. The little ones should rest. In the car, Diego was silent. Did you already eat? I asked. Not really, he said. We stopped at a McDonald's, and I ordered a sausage McMuffin, and Diego ordered two sausage breakfast burritos. As we waited to pull up to the window, he handed me money. It's okay, I told him. I'll pay. No, he said. My mom gave me this money. She'd be mad if you paid. Okay, I told him. Okay. I smiled. Thanks for breakfast. You know, I said as he unwrapped his first burrito, your dad used to eat a breakfast burrito every morning at work. He would always give me half. I stared out at the road and took a bite of my sandwich. I asked Diego about school, about what he did for fun. I like soccer, he said. Oh yeah, I asked. What's your favorite club? I don't really have one, he said. I just like to play. I play in the park with my brothers. My dad used to take us. I'm on a team for church, too. He took another bite from his burrito. What position do you play? I asked. I'm a striker, he said. I'm the one who makes the goals. After nearly an hour of driving, the sun finally rose above the horizon and cast its first rays upon the desert flatlands and fields dormant with crops. We slowed as we began to pass buildings and houses, and we soon made out the prison complexes towering in the distance. We drove through quiet streets, past a high school, a trading post, an Italian restaurant, until finally we arrived at the massive detention center at the opposite edge of town. Outside, a guard in a white truck was checking vehicles at the entrance to the parking lot. I rolled down my window. We're here for visitation, I told him. What cell block? I read him the information I had taken down. That block doesn't have visitation until 9, he said. Really? I asked. But online, it said, the guard cut me off. 9 a.m., he repeated. I looked at Diego and then back at the guard. Is there somewhere we can wait? I asked. I could feel him glaring at me through his sunglasses. There's a diner in town, he said. You can wait there. It was nearly 7 when we pulled into the diner parking lot. Diego and I sat in a booth by the window and stared out in silence as the amber light of the sun spilled across the asphalt. A waitress sauntered over with two menus and a pitcher of water. Good morning, she said. I'll bet you boys are hungry. I looked up at her and smiled. To tell you the truth, I said, we already ate. We're waiting for visitation at the prison. You must get that a lot. Sometimes, she said. Well, I continued, is it all right if we nurse some coffee and order something small? She smiled and nodded toward the only other customer, a stout man in a cowboy hat, bantering at the counter with another waitress. Any business is good business, she said. The waitress took our menus and left as we stared again out the window. Do your parents let you drink coffee? I asked Diego. Yeah, he said, but I don't really like how it tastes. Your dad drinks it with vanilla and cream, I told him. I turned my head and looked across the table at him, small and slumped against the back of the booth. Oh, he said, I didn't know. I never saw my dad in the mornings. 2 hours later, back at the entrance to the prison, the guard in the white truck stuck his hand out the window as we approached. I rolled down the window. Visitation is closed. It's 9 a.m., I said. What do you mean? There's a riot in cell block E. Visitation is closed. I looked at Diego and then back at the guard. For how long? I asked. The man shrugged. How am I supposed to know? Until they stop rioting. I arranged to meet Lupe in the Mercado at the end of my shift. I had offered to help her sort through documents and deliver them to Elizabeth's law firm. She was seated at a small table with her hair pulled back in a tight bun. She smiled as I approached, standing to greet me with timid familiarity. As we sat down, she slung a large woven bag into her lap and pulled out a thick stack of papers loosely gathered in a manila folder. I briefly scanned through them. There were documents from 1981, from 1990, from 1993, 1994, 1997, 2002, 2003, 2005, 2009, 2012, 2015. There were Jose's old ID cards, pay stubs and W-2s, insurance forms, rental agreements, utility bills, medical records, statements of payment and credit history. Everything stacked together in no particular order. A bulging dossier on a life lived on the workaday margins of a country now set in motion against him. I left the documents with Lupe and asked her to excuse me for a minute. I walked across the courtyard and knocked on the open door to Diane's office. "Come in," I heard her say. "Lupe's here," I said, "and she's got a lot of documents." "Good," Diane replied. "Actually," I said, "they're kind of a mess. Is there a big table somewhere we can lay them out and organize things?" "Of course," she said. She led me down the hall to a conference room. "It's free until later this afternoon," she told me. "Do you need anything else?" "Maybe some markers and a set of folders," I said. "There's office supplies in the next room," Diane said. "Take whatever you need." For the next 2 hours, Lupe and I stood at the conference table, sorting through piles of papers, some of them faded and yellowing. Documents providing evidence of Jose's entry into the United States at age 11, and the work he had been engaged in every year thereafter, earning minimum wage as a dishwasher, a busboy, a custodian, an auto repairman, a maintenance man, a farm worker, a fruit picker, an agricultural equipment operator, a carpet mill factory worker, a truck driver, a construction hand. Documents providing certification of his marriage, certification of the birth of each of his 3 sons, certification of his mother's death. Documents providing evidence of the growing lives of his children. Children who visited the school nurse and the local health clinic. Children who received brain scans, behavioral health reports, cognitive speech and language therapy. Children who received report cards and teacher's notes. Children who were being shaped by the twin identities of immigrant and citizen. As Lupe and I sorted through the documents, I labeled distinct folders and placed each document in its corresponding place. "Work," I scrawled on one folder, "residence" on another. I labeled one folder "dependents" and placed a folder for each child inside of it, and within each of these, separate folders labeled "school," "medical," and "proof of citizenship." I saw ID photos of Jose as a young man with feathered black hair, his skin dark and glaring with the light from the flashbulb. I saw ID photos of his sons, their faces round with baby fat, and I saw the prints of their newborn hands and feet inked on the hospital documents that certified their birth. I saw his and Lupe's signatures over and over again, printed simply in block letters on form after form, year after year. When we finally finished, I walked with Lupe back across the courtyard. As we said our goodbyes, a woman named Anna, a worker at the Mexican bakery, stepped into the courtyard to greet Lupe. She asked about Jose, about the boys, about the stack of documents in my hands. "They're for Jose's case," Lupe said. "He's taking them to the lawyer." Anna smiled at me. "It's so nice of you to help the family," she said. She touched me on the shoulder and looked at Lupe, lowering her voice. "It's hard to imagine that he was La Migra, isn't it?" "Oh, really?" Lupe asked, her eyes widening in surprise. "Jose didn't tell you?" I asked. "No," she said, elongating the word. "That's right," said Anna. "He saw what we go through at the border, and look, now he's helping." I smiled and nodded, wondering if that's what this really was, if I was merely being driven to make good for all the lives I had sent back across the line, if I was seeking to dole out some paltry reparation. If I was seeking redemption, I wondered, what would redemption look like? Lupe came to the door after my first knock. "Good morning," she smiled. "It's not so early this time," she said. She disappeared into the house, and I could hear her calling after Diego. She came back to the door with papers in her hand. Disculpa, she said, but would you mind if Jose Jr. came too? Last time he was so sad not to go. Como no, I said. I gestured at the documents in her hand. Are those his papers? Yes, she said, handing them over. Diego walked up behind his mother and stood beside her in the doorway. You're almost as tall as your mom, I said. He stood up straight and smiled. Actually, he said, I'm taller. His mother swiped at him playfully. I'm almost as tall as my dad, he said, proudly. As we drove north toward the detention center, Diego looked at his phone, and Jose Jr. played a game of soccer on an iPod Touch in the back seat, pumping his hand in the air each time he scored a goal, and then passing the device up to his brother, insisting he watch each computer-generated replay. After about 10 minutes, Diego became bored with his phone and turned around in his seat. Let me play, he said to Jose Jr. But you have your phone, his brother whined. I know, Diego replied, but it doesn't have soccer. Jose Jr. surrendered the iPod and looked around the inside of the vehicle. I hope we get back before school's out, he said. I turned and looked at him. He was clutching the shoulder strap of his seatbelt. Why? I thought most kids love to skip school. Not me, he said. I like school. Yesterday, my teacher said she was going to give us treats at the end of the day today. We even voted on what kind of cupcakes we like. Diego thrust his arm up in the seat next to me. Gol, he shouted. He turned to his brother. Look, Diego said, showing his brother the replay. I'm going to score a goal just like this on Saturday. After several minutes, Jose Jr. leaned toward Diego from the back seat and touched him on the shoulder. Look, he said, it's floating. Diego put down the iPod. What are you talking about? That thing on the side of the road, Jose Jr. said. If you stare at it, it looks like it's floating. Diego looked out his window at the passing road. I don't get it, he said. What do you mean? The bar, Jose Jr. said. I turned and looked out the window at the guardrail running along the shoulder of the highway. When I stared at it, straight on, the wooden posts holding it up blurred together as they sped past, giving the illusion of a steel barrier hovering above the ground. You mean the guardrail? I asked. Jose Jr. smiled at me. Yeah, he said. It's floating. At the detention center, I reminded the boys to leave everything in the car. Phones, iPods, wallets, even your belts, I said. We followed another visitor across the lot toward a gate in the towering, two-tiered fence topped with coils of concertina wire. After five of us had gathered in front of the gate, it slowly wheeled open by remote, and we passed through into the sallyport, waiting patiently for it to close again behind us. Above me, I heard the call of a mourning dove lilting up from somewhere on the roof of the prison. The wind blew gently against the wires, jostling the arms of a bumpy and bare-skinned cactus beside the walkway. Jose Jr. nudged Diego. Sounds like our mom is talking to us. I looked at the chain-link fence, trembling with the gusts of cool air. You mean the wind? I asked him. Or the birds? Jose Jr. thought for a second. All of it, he said. Jose Jr. held his hand up to his face to block the sun and looked toward the door of the prison. I feel like I've been here before, he said to me. Really? I asked. Yeah, like maybe in a dream. He walked to the cactus at the end of the walkway, and I noticed, for the first time, a slight limp in his gait. He looked up at the fence, and his baggy t-shirt, a hand-me-down from one of his brothers, rippled in the wind. The gate finally closed behind us with a metallic crash, and a guard opened the door to the prison. I watched the two women in front of us make their way through the line. Following their example, I took a sheet of paper from a countertop and filled out Jose's name, inmate number, and cell block. When it was my turn at the window, I handed the paper to the guard. He typed at his computer and chewed at a bushy white mustache. Martinez Cruz? He finally asked. Yes, sir, I said. What's your relation? I'm a friend, I replied. These are his boys. Are you their guardian? For the day, I said. I handed him a notarized letter from Lupe. Do you have their papers? He asked. Yes, sir, I said, handing him the boys' birth certificates. The man typed some more, and then instructed us to empty our pockets and pass through the metal detector into the waiting room. The boys sat next to each other in hard plastic seats. Diego fidgeted with his hands, and Jose Jr. swung his legs back and forth. The two women who came in before us sat across from each other and facing chairs. "I like your shoes," one woman said to the other. "Are they Vans?" "Coach," she answered. "Oh." The woman looked down at her legs and wiggled her feet. "I just got these at Dollar General." "That works too," the other woman said. "They're kind of cute." After a few more minutes, the woman with the coach shoes asked the other if she had visited the prison before. "One other time," the woman answered, "on a Sunday." "It was busy," she said, shaking her head. "I think weekdays are the way to go." I looked back at the boys. Jose Jr. sat holding his face in his hands. To pass the time, I began to walk around the room, gazing at the posters on the wall from the Corrections Corporation of America. "Zero tolerance suicide prevention," said one. "Be a hero. Keep it at zero." "Opportunity is knocking," said another. "CCA is currently accepting applications." Another poster depicted a smiling black man. "I believe everybody needs a little fun in their life. I am Terry Williams, Jr., a senior corrections officer in Tennessee. I am CCA." Next to it, another showed an older white woman beaming with pride. "My name is Mary Bauermaster. I am a shift supervisor in Florida, and I believe you should never stop learning. I am CCA." And another, "I get to teach people how to live better lives. I am Jason Russell, a nurse and a woodworker in Mississippi. I am CCA." I stood before the photographed faces and thought about the kinship I shared with them. The badge, the gun, the wrangling of human beings, the slow severing of spirit. In the distance, jangling keys began to echo through the room, and I turned my head to hear the calling of the guards. We were given sheets of paper and instructed to walk back to our cars and drive around the building to another entrance. "I'm confused," I said to the guard. "I thought this was visitation." "This is check-in," the guard said. "Visitation is on the other side." Back in the car, I followed the woman with the coach shoes as she drove around the building to make sure I arrived at the right entrance. I ushered the boys out of the car once again and joined the two women in front of another entrance, where we waited for another gate to open. Diego shuffled his feet, and Jose Jr. stood looking again at the top of the fence. "I really don't know why I have the feeling I've been here before," he said. He looked down at the ground. "I can't handle the pressure," Jose Jr. mumbled to himself. "What do you mean?" I asked. "I don't know if I can handle talking to my dad." I looked at Diego and then back at his brother. "Why not?" Jose Jr. sighed. "Because he's in jail." We were finally let in through the prison doors by the same mustachioed guard who had taken our documents at check-in. He took the sheets of paper we had been given and instructed us to pass, once again, through a metal detector. We were led down a hallway and made to wait for several minutes while the guards chatted with a co-worker who had just finished his shift. "I'll catch you in D-Block tomorrow," the guard said. "Hell no you won't," his co-worker replied. "I've got the day off. I'm taking the wife and kids to the ballpark." "Well," the guard scoffed, "look at you." The guard led us to a doorway and stopped to give us instructions before letting us through. "You'll have 45 minutes to visit," he said. "I'll give a 10-minute warning before time is up. You'll be using the phones mounted on the wall next to the window," he continued. "Each prisoner has a code to dial out. Wait until the phone rings before you pick it up, or else you won't have a connection. Plastic chairs are stacked against the back wall to the right. Grab one as you enter the room and stack them back where you got them on your way out." As the guard spoke, I noticed that he looked only at the women and me, that he never lowered his gaze to regard the boys. When he opened the door, I stood behind the boys and ushered them forward. The inside of the visitation room was brightly lit with cinder block walls painted in pale tan. The two women were first through the door and walked directly to the stack of plastic chairs. The guard closed the door behind us and then walked to a desk in the corner of the room and took a seat behind a computer monitor. The boys stood unmoving, just a few feet beyond the entrance, staring at their father as he waved from behind a reinforced glass window. He smiled widely at them, standing on his feet, swaying from side to side. I kneeled down to speak to the boys. "Go ahead," I told them. "I'll bring the chairs." When I walked up to the window, Jose Jr. had already taken up the receiver and was speaking with his father. Jose's head and face were shaved, and he looked strong again, like he had regained the weight he'd lost in the desert. Jose Jr. remained standing at the window even after I placed a chair behind him. He spoke eagerly with his father about school, about his friends at church. He told his father that he missed him, that it was sad at the house without him. Behind us, the guard stood up from his computer and placed something in a microwave on a countertop next to the desk. The beeping of the keypad rang out through the room, and I watched the man chew at his mustache as he stood waiting for his meal. On either side of me, I observed the women speaking to men clad in orange, their faces held close against the glass. "This is love," one of the women said into the receiver. "Things are the same out here," the other woman said softly. "Everything is the same." I looked back at Jose and watched the way he tilted his head as he gazed through the glass, the way he smiled as he listened to his son. I watched the motion of his mouth, the way he spoke and laughed. It was like watching a man on mute, I thought, a man who, despite his proximity, would not be heard even if he was crying out on the other side of the glass, even if he was screaming. After 10 minutes or so, Jose Jr. handed the phone to Diego. Jose smiled warmly as his oldest son told him about soccer, about playing with his brothers in the park. His face grew more serious as Diego spoke with him about his grades, about his youngest brother's health, about what he was doing to help Lupe around the house. At times, Jose stared down at the ground, closing his eyes and rubbing his brow. "Mom is working a lot more," Diego told him. "She gets annoyed with us sometimes. But she's fine," he said. "She's just tired." Diego set the phone down on the ledge beneath the window. "My dad wants to talk to you," he told me. "Oh," I said, "sure." I stood and grabbed my chair, moving it closer to the window. I picked up the handset. "Paco," Jose said to me, smiling. His voice sounded tinny and distant in the receiver. I smiled back. "Jose, brother." Lupe came by the coffee shop in the morning on her way back from dropping the boys at school and delivered a packet of letters she had collected from family, friends, neighbors, former employers, and fellow church members. I had arranged to deliver them to the law firm as soon as my shift was over. She handed me the envelope and smiled timidly. I noticed a tinge of apprehension in her gaze, as if she was still trying to comprehend the image of me as a lawman, trying to discern in me an old shadow of darkness. "It's been so good of you to help us," she said. I shook my head. "It's nothing. Jose is a friend." I looked away. Lupe glanced toward the door. "I've got to get ready for work," she told me. "I'm picking up shifts at the restaurant where Jose used to work." "Qué bien," I said. "Estamos en contacto." She waved goodbye and walked across the courtyard to her car. At the end of my shift, I drove to Elizabeth's office and sat with my engine running in the parking lot. I opened the envelope that contained Jose's letters and began to flip through them. Some were typed, but most were handwritten, many of them in Spanish. They all began with some variation of "to whom it may concern." They referred to Jose as a brother in Christ, a family man, a good father, a responsible husband, a reliable person, always working hard, always giving his best, always offering to help with a smile on his face, always laughing. "To whom this may concern," began one letter. "My name is Brenda Cuellar. I've lived in the United States of America for over 25 years, and am now a proud U.S. citizen. I have known my fellow friend and brother Jose for over 3 years approximately. We congregate at the same church, and we both serve in the ushers department. Jose Martinez has always been such a joy to be around. He is a responsible and caring father, which is projected from his 3 young sons. Jose Martinez is a hard-working man who has never left a task uncompleted. It would be a mistake to let such a hard worker, responsible father, and awesome friend go. Please consider my testimony, and if there are further questions, feel free to contact me." Another man from Jose's church wrote, "Jose is a good father, a good husband, and a good employee. He's a good example of a good citizen. He always helps people instead of looking for help." Many friends and family members made an effort to write their letters in a way that echoed the language of official documents. "I, Leticia Martinez, declare under penalty of perjury that the following statement is true and correct to the best of my knowledge and recollection. To whom it may concern, I'm Leticia Martinez. I'm Jose's niece. He has been living in this country for many years. He is a very nice person. He does not drink or smoke or use any drugs. He is a very responsible and hardworking person. I wish that he had a chance to let him stay with his children in this country. Thanks for taking the time to read this letter. To whom it may concern, wrote another man. In the matter of allowing Jose Martinez to stay in the United States of America, I, Pablo G. Martinez, believe Jose M. should be allowed to stay in the country for the following reasons. He is a hardworking man that holds down two jobs. He is the head of household. Without him, his family would struggle very much, both financially and emotionally. He has three little boys who need their father in their lives. He is one of the most respectable people I know and should definitely be allowed to stay in this great country. Lupe wrote in Spanish on line school paper borrowed from her children. I, Lupe Valderas, declare that Jose Martinez Cruz is my husband since the year 1999. We have three boys, age 15, 10, and 8. We were always a very exemplary family. We would go out when my husband was off work. He was the only one who worked. He had two jobs, and his free time was dedicated to us. My husband is an exemplary father and a caring spouse. He doesn't drink. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't use drugs. He only dedicates himself to making his family happy. But now we miss him very much because I, Lupe, cannot take my boys to the park because lately I have been unwell. My husband took my boys to play soccer every Wednesday, and on weekends he dedicated his time to us to eat and to go out, and now we miss him. My husband has given 16 years of happiness and love to my sons and me, but we won't return to Mexico because my boys don't know anyone there, and they speak very little Spanish, and it's very difficult to adapt to another country when their whole life has been here, they were born here, and they are growing here. For us as parents, we want the best for our sons, Diego, Jose Jr., and Vicente. We miss my husband because he was responsible at home. I am his wife, and I love him very much, and I miss him. Diego, Jose Jr., and Vicente miss him. We love you very much. We give hope to God that very soon we will be together, because God does not like to see his children separated. Vicente Martinez, Jose's youngest boy, wrote his own name at the top of a letter, scrawled in pencil on ruled school paper. There were no spaces between his words, and his writing was riddled with misspellings and backward letters. Hi, Daddy. I love you because you take us to the park and to play soccer. I miss you because you take us to the stores, and you take us to go to work and to get money to feed us. The final two lines of Vicente's letter were incomprehensible, a jumble of letters that sometimes approximated words and sounds in Spanish. The Spanish word for God, Dios, could be discerned, and, perhaps, the word for church, Iglesia. I miss you very much, Vicente wrote clearly at the end. Te extraño mucho. Jose Jr. had written on two half sheets of paper. On one of them, he wrote a brief letter addressed to his father, much like that of his younger brother. At the bottom of the message, he taped a wallet-sized picture of himself with tattered edges. On the second sheet of paper, Jose Jr. drew his family on a soccer field with frowning faces. The stick figures labeled Mom, Brother, Big Brother. Below it was another drawing, almost identical, except this time the stick figures had smiles on their faces, and an extra figure drawn next to them, labeled Dad. Diego wrote a letter that continued across several sheets of paper. At 2.5 pages, it was the longest of any in the packet. In its opening paragraphs, Diego seemed to realize that his father would likely not see or read his words, and he did his best to maintain a formal tone. Dear to whom it may concern, the letter began. Hi, I'm Diego Martinez. I'm the son of Jose Martinez. I'm his oldest son. I'm 15 years old. I have two younger brothers. One is 10 and the other is 8. I'm working to keep my brothers happy, to buy them what they want to keep them happy. Well, my dad, Jose, is the nicest guy I know. My dad is like my best friend and my father. I treat my dad with so much respect. He's the father any kid would want to have. My mom and my whole family broke down when we saw him in court on the first court he had. Everyone started crying. In the second court, when his friend to work took me and my brothers, I broke down so much when I heard his voice, it got me into so much tears. I miss my dad. He knew how to cheer us up when we were down. He took us to the park on Monday and Wednesday to play soccer with our church friend. He got along with everyone at church. My dad was the coolest person, most nicest, most religious, most caring person. Always made my mom happy, always putting a smile in our faces every single day. He's also very smart and very funny. My dad always has a smile on his face, trying to always help people who are in need. How I feel right now about my dad being in jail and seeing him like this makes me really sad, depressed my father isn't here with us. Everyone that asks about my dad makes me sad to say he's in jail. My heart kind of stops, pauses, and breaks down on every letter they send him. He was a man with 3 children and 1 woman. Each one of my friends I've had for many years loved my dad because he took us to places, like to any place appropriate, to mountains in the west, to parks, to many places in the city. My dad did anything to make us happy. Now my life is depressing, hollow. My dad's not here. A missing place for him. Here waits. My dad's a very responsible man. When I was little, my dad was always by my side, and always will still be by my side. I pray to God that my dad is always okay. I miss my dad so much, it's really hard to express and write. I miss you so much, Dad. You always told us to never look back and always look forward. Thanks for always being there for us and never letting us go, Dad. We miss you so much. Just remember, God is always by our side, never letting us go. We all want them to set you free here. Everyone at church and his 2 works misses him a lot. Everyone misses my dad. Nobody wants him to get sent back to Mexico. Everyone's praying for you to let you out safely and still the same Jose we know. Dad, we have a tournament for soccer for church on the 26th of this month. I'll be making goals for you. The goals will be for you. You taught me how to play soccer and told me never give up. Dad, I'm gonna win that trophy for us. I'm training with everything I got to get better each day. Thank you to whoever got the time to read this. I'm sorry it's so long. It's because I really love my dad. We all do. We're all sad to know he's in jail. Sincerely, his oldest son, Diego Martinez. As I drove home after a shift at the coffee shop, my phone lit up with a text message. Hey, it's Diego. I just wanted to tell you that they're going to deport my dad back in the night. Then, a few hours later, an email from Elizabeth Green. Unfortunately, I just received a message from the deportation officer that our request for prosecutorial discretion and a stay of removal was denied. I know no one wants this news. Jose had a great application with more support than I have ever seen in any of my other requests. They did not give a reason for the denial. The message states Jose will be removed to Mexico this evening. I stared at the screen, thinking of Lupe and the boys, wondering where Jose would sleep in the night. In the evening, I received a text message from Lupe. I'm sorry, but can you call the lawyer? Jose needs to see my baby because he fell and they're going to operate. I called Lupe right away. Vicentito's in the hospital, she told me. He fell and broke his arm playing soccer in the park. They're going to put screws in his arm, she said. I told her that I was sorry, that I would help in any way I could. But why do you want me to call the lawyer? I asked. Oh, Lupe said hurriedly, so that Jose can come see Vicente before they send him back. She sounded desperate, at the edge, with something in her voice I had not yet heard. I tried to speak gently. There's no way to get a hold of Jose, I said. Immigration agents have him now. They're taking him back to the border. The lawyer can't contact them. Oh, I heard her say. I tried to come up with some words of comfort. I'm sure Jose will call when he's across the border, I said. Lupe was silent. Okay, she finally said. I understand. As I walked, trembling in the night through the streets of my neighborhood, I called my mother. She asked how I was doing, and I answered unthinkingly. I'm fine. You don't sound fine, she said. What do you mean? I asked. My mother sighed. I'm your mother, she said. I can sense it. You've been distant. I felt an edge in her voice. This feels like it used to feel, she finally said. I stopped walking. I don't understand, I told her. It's like when you were on the border, she said. All those years, I knew things were weighing on you, but you were so sensitive to my questions. I couldn't ask about it. I couldn't show concern. I could never reach you. I don't want that again. I'm too tired for it now. I stood for a while at the side of the street, staring out at the houses of my neighbors. Finally, I sat down on the curb. When did you know? I asked. She paused. Something had gone away from our conversations, she said. I don't know how to describe it. She searched for a better explanation. There's a story I remember from Catholic school, she told me. There was this brilliant child, a music prodigy. He could play anything. He would hear birds sing and then turn it into music. At a very young age, he was sent away to be trained by monks. When he arrived at the monastery, they forbade him from hearing any music but his own. They forbade him from listening to any of the famous composers. They wanted him to write and create his own music. And for many years he did. He created the most phenomenal things. But as he got a bit older, he became frustrated. He wanted to study. He wanted to hear other kinds of music. And so one day, he snuck away from the monastery. He went to a nearby town and went into a concert hall, where he heard Mozart. When he came back, he didn't tell anyone. He kept creating new music just like before. A few days after his return, the monks heard him playing, and they told him to stop. "You've broken the rule," they told him. He looked at them with panic and insisted, "No, I haven't. I haven't. I haven't." They shook their heads and said, "Yes, you have. You've discovered Mozart." "No," he said. "How could you know that?" "Because," they said, "when you played without knowing, you played music from every composer. And now, Mozart is missing." When she finished the story, my mother fell silent. I sat hunched on the curb, the phone pressed against my ear. "My friend," I finally told her, "he's been deported." I felt unable to breathe. "I fear for him," I said. "I fear for his family." "All these years," I told her, "it's like I've been circling beneath a giant, my gaze fixed upon its foot, resting at the ground. But now," I said, "it's like I'm starting to crane my head upward, like I'm finally seeing the thing that crushes." On the phone, Lupe told me that Jose was safe. "He's staying at the border," she said, "with a man from our church. He has food and shelter there." "Gracias a Dios," she kept saying. "Bendito sea Dios." She told me that Jose hadn't decided his next move yet, but that he was looking for someone to cross him again. I wanted to tell her no, that Jose should not risk his life, that he should find some other way. But I knew, with sinking certainty, that for him, there was no other option. And so I remained silent. I asked Lupe about the boys, and she told me that an uncle, with papers, had offered to take them across the border so they could see their father. It would be good for them to see him someplace besides the jail, she said. It would be good for them to be able to hug him. She added that she wished she could take the boys herself, that she wished she could see her husband with her own eyes. A week later, I checked in again with Lupe. "Did the boys see Jose?" I asked. "Yes," she said, "but not Vicente. He just got his arm put in a cast." "He's a little sad," she explained. "He hasn't seen his daddy since he was in court." Lupe told me that Jose was still at the border, that he planned to cross again soon, maybe this weekend, that everything was fine, that he told her not to worry. Several days later, Lupe sent a text message. "Jose told me he'd cross Sunday to walk through the desert, but I'm worried now, because it's been 3 days and I still haven't heard anything from him." Then, a few days later, "Buenos dias. Jose is back at the border. La Migra chased him, but his group scattered, and they couldn't catch him. Gracias a Dios. His body aches. He has a fever. He needs rest." I dream that I am at work, that Diane is sitting at the bar drinking a latte. "Look," Diane says, pointing through the open doors across the courtyard. "It's Jose." I look out and see a gaunt man with a gray beard, wandering slowly and aimlessly along the walkway. I leave the counter and make my way to him. He is wearing a black baseball hat, and a gray shirt hangs loosely from his thin shoulders. "Jose," I say, "you're back." His eyes are sunken in their sockets. His face is dark and old. "I've been in the desert," he says. "There are things I could tell you." I ran into Diane and her children in the checkout line of the grocery store. "Listen," she told me as she wrested a candy bar from the clutches of her 5-year-old daughter. "We want to give something to Jose's family for Christmas. The kids raise money at a bake sale, and they want Lupe and the boys to have it." "Oh, that's so sweet," I said. I looked down at Diane's daughter, twirling in circles beside the magazine rack. "Do you have any idea what the boys like?" Diane asked. "I know they like soccer," I told her. "I could get them a gift certificate to the soccer shop," she suggested, "and maybe a certificate to Target for Lupe. She could get whatever she needs there, you know, things for the house, school supplies, clothes for the boys." I smiled. "That'd be great," I said. "I'm sure they'd really appreciate it." Diane reached out to stop her infant son, seated in the shopping cart, from ingesting a tube of lip balm. She sighed. "Sorry," she said. "If I give you the certificates later this week, do you think you could deliver them to Lupe for me?" "I don't speak Spanish," she said. "We won't be able to understand each other." I nodded. "Of course," I said. At the doorstep of her trailer, Lupe shied away from me as I held out the envelope to her. "It's too much," she said. "I can't take it." "Diane's kids raised the money," I told her. "They want you to have it." She breathed in and lifted her face toward the sky with a look of resignation. "It's a gift," I told her. "It's almost Christmas." Lupe squinted at the sun and then took the envelope, stared down at the ground. "I don't know how to thank them," she said. "Will you tell them how much I appreciate it?" Before I left, I asked Lupe about Jose. "Oh," she said, "things are hard right now. Un poco difícil." She told me Jose had crossed again a week ago and was caught by the border patrol. "He didn't go to court," she said. "They didn't send him to prison, but they bust him away, far from here. They deported him through Mexicali." I shook my head. "They do that sometimes," I told her, "to make it harder for them to cross in the same place again." "Well," she said, "he's still trying to get across, but there's some problems with the coyotes." "What's the problem?" I asked. Lupe interlaced her fingers in front of her stomach. "It's just that he's afraid of them. Tiene un poco miedo." She paused. "I'm afraid too," she added. I asked her what had happened, and she looked into the distance and began wringing her hands. "What happened is that 3 or 4 days after Jose crossed, I still hadn't heard anything from him. One morning I got a call from this man who said they needed extra money to get Jose to the city. He said that Jose was in a safe house, but that they needed $1,000 to bring him the rest of the way. I asked him to put Jose on the phone so I would know he was telling the truth, but the man said he wasn't with him. He told me that Jose was fine, that I should trust him, that they just needed an extra $1,000 to finish the trip. I told the man to call me back when he could put Jose on the phone. I'll give the money once I talk to him," I said, and I hung up. Lupe began to talk more slowly, drawing out her sentences, speaking through one side of her mouth. The rest of the morning, I didn't know what to do with myself. I took the boys to school. I didn't tell them about the phone call. I came back home, and for a while I just sat around the house, trying to think of what to do. But finally I went out to take cash from the bank. I was shaking the whole time. Later that same day, she continued, two men came to my door just before sundown. They told me that if I wanted Jose to make it home, I'd better give them the money right there. The boys were home from school by then, she said. They didn't know what to think. What was I supposed to do? She turned her palms up in a small gesture of surrender. I was scared, she said. She drew her shoulders around her neck and shook her head to one side and shuddered. I wanted to reach out and touch her. The men took the money and left, Lupe continued. They said not to worry, that they'd bring Jose in the morning. I couldn't even sleep that night. I didn't know what to do. Lupe began wringing her hands again. By the next afternoon, they still hadn't come, so I dialed the same number they had called me from the day before. A different man answered this time. He told me he didn't know what I was talking about, and he said I'd better calm down, that I'd better wait, patiently. That if I knew what was good for me, I wouldn't call again. And then he hung up.